Hi, I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The June 5th primary election here in California is fast approaching, with voters having the opportunity to weigh in on a number of local and statewide issues. Californians will cast ballots for their presidential nominees, even though the Democratic and Republican choices have pretty much already been determined. But voters will also have choices to make for the U.S. Senate seat, now held by Dianne Feinstein, and all of California's 53 House districts. In those races, as well as those for State Assembly and Senate, for the first time, we'll be taking part in the new top two primaries system, in which voters for all parties can cast ballots for candidates of any party. And then there are the two propositions on the ballot. Proposition 28, which would reduce the time legislators can serve in the legislature from 14 years to 12, while allowing them to serve those 12 years in a single house. And Proposition 29, which would impose an additional $1 tax per pack of cigarettes to fund cancer research. We're also going to see the impact of the work done by the Citizens Redistricting Commission, which redrew the lines for nearly every congressional and legislative district in the state. And of course, there are lots of local elections and ballot measures that are out there as well, which if you are interested in talking about one, we'd be glad to hear from you. One thing that elections and Your Call have in common is that a key measure of their success is participation. So if you'd like to vote on Tuesday but feel unprepared, we'd like to hear the questions that you have. If there is a primary race or a proposition that has gotten your blood up, or a local issue you think is critical but hasn't gotten the attention it deserved, please get in touch with us. Be part of this conversation. And the bigger question, how is electoral democracy in California doing? There are so many people in this state who feel discouraged about voting or who see it as marginal to their lives. What do you think could change that? There are lots of ways for you to be part of this conversation about next Tuesday's election and democracy in California. You can call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can email feedback@yourcallradio.org or post a comment or question at yourcallradio.org, our new website, which makes it real easy for what you have to say to be seen by other listeners. In a moment, we're going to be joined by Kim Alexander, president and founder of the California Voter Foundation. Right now with us is Peter Schrag. He's the former editorial page editor and columnist of the Sacramento Bee and a frequent contributor to the California Progress Report. He's the author of Paradise Lost, California's Experience, America's Future, and his most recent book, Not Fit for Our Society, Immigration and Nativism in America. Peter, great to have you with us.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Well, first, let's start with the process thing that people are going to notice, certainly, as they walk into the polling booth on Tuesday, and that is the top two primary. Just give us the thumbnail sketch of what that means, which office it applies to, and what that will look like for folks.
The top two means that for any office, candidates of whatever party or no party will be on the same ballot, and you can vote for anyone regardless of your party and regardless of their party. And then the top two finishers, say in a race for the legislature or for Congress, will then meet each other in the general election in November. So we could have two Republicans or two Democrats facing each other in November. But anyway, it's a very different system from what we had.
So Kim Alexander is with us. She's the president and founder of the California Voter Foundation, and that's an organization that works to improve the election process so that it better serves voters. Kim, in terms of the voting process, what's it going to be like, as folks say, want to vote for a U.S. Senate candidate in this primary on Tuesday? How is that going to be different with the top two process?
Well, the first thing voters are going to notice is that there are many more choices on their ballot than they're used to. I mean, normally in a primary, you only see the candidates of your own party listed on the ballot. In this election, you're going to see the candidates of every party's primary on the ballot. So that's a lot more candidates for voters to get through. For independent voters, they're going to see a lot of candidates that they never saw before, because normally they don't have anyone to choose from unless there's local contests on the ballot. So 20% of our registered voters in California are registered independent. We now call that no party preference, and they're going to have many more choices in this election than they are used to.
So, like for the U.S. Senate, for Dianne Feinstein's seat, 24 candidates, right?
Yes, a lot of candidates. Surprisingly, no party preference candidates in that race, though.
Okay, and so let's go back to where this idea. So this was Proposition 14. Which when did we approve that as voters?
We approved that in June 2010, and basically it was the pet idea of a legislator whose vote was needed to pass the budget, and that was Abel Maldonado. and he wanted to see this change happen. And so the powers that be in the Capitol agreed to it, and they got his budget vote, and they approved this measure on the ballot. The voters approved it in June, and we have this new system in place.
So, Peter Schrag, talk about what was the idea, what was the rationale for that change, and then, you know, kind of what you think of, is thinking about what people are facing on Tuesday, how it might change the way people make
the rationale
decisions.
Was that in the old system with party primaries, it was the party, the true believers, or the true, I won't say the extremes, but people who are very committed to one side or another who voted, so that the final candidates tended to be more to the right or to the left, respectively, than many California voters were. At least that was the theory. The idea now of this new system is that because candidates all have to appeal to a wide spectrum of voters, because anybody can vote Democrats, Republicans, decline the state, candidates would become, there would be more moderate candidates, and that it would generate a more moderate, less partisan legislature or congressional delegation than we've had before.
So this is the first primary when we're using this system. Obviously, we're going to have to wait and see if it actually has the kind of effects that people thought it might have. Kim, are there examples of other states in the country that have similar kind of systems?
I know Washington State has a primary system that's open like ours, but no, I mean, most other states have a very closed system. You know, the impact of this is going to be different whether you're talking about the state legislature or you're talking about Congress. When, in terms of the state legislature, this rule change applies to all contests. Everybody who's in the legislature is now running under this new system, which is bringing more competition to incumbents in the primary, along with our redistricting, which happened with the Citizens Commission, has brought more competition as well. But that's a different situation in Congress, where this isn't a process other states are going through. And so if California ends up electing a number of people to Congress who are independents, then that kind of impacts California's standing in the Congress, because we're not adding people to the Congressional Republican Caucus or the Congressional Democratic Caucus. We've got people who, you know, may be caucusing in a phone booth or something. So, you know, some people are saying, well, we don't know if this is going to be good for California's interests at the federal level. But, you know, we have to kind of wait and see. There are a few other independents scattered about in Congress, and maybe they will be able to form a voting bloc.
Well, and also kind of it changes the dynamic within parties in some very strong Democratic or Republican congressional districts, right? I mean, we're going to be talking a little later in the hour about some of those races here in the Bay Area. Think of Pete Stark's seat,
yeah,
and Woolsey's seat. And so I definitely want to get back to talking more about that.
Can I ask a question here?
Sure.
Given the fact that the voters, in fact, are sorted out by the districts, almost all districts tend to be either predominantly Republican or predominantly Democratic, even after last redistricting. Doesn't that mean that we will still be electing a great many people who are either solid Republicans or solid Democrats?
I think so, but I think more people are going to be involved in that decision-making process. I mean, you know, one example I've been looking at before this rule change is Assembly District 25 up this way in Modesto. The woman who was elected to represent that district is Kristen Olson, and she was elected in she won the June 2010 primary. It was a closed primary. There were seven total opponents in that Republican primary, and she won it with less than 15,000 votes, and she had no competition in the general. So that what's different is that it used to be that the contests were decided in the primary, and once you won the primary, you pretty much walked off with the general. Now we're going to see, you know, real competition in the general election as well, and many times between people of the same party. So I think that does really, it creates more competition throughout the process and more opportunities for voters to be courted and to weigh in on their choices.
I want to give out the number for folks who want to call in and take part in this conversation. You're listening to Your Call. We're talking about next Tuesday's primary election here in California. If you have been tuned into this and have specific issues or candidates, races you want to talk about, we welcome your call. Or if you're kind of like, oh, I'm just kind of getting with what's going on next Tuesday, and you have questions, whether it's about the top two primary or about, say, Propositions 28 and 29 that are on the statewide ballot, the number to call is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. 8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. If we could switch gears and actually talk about the substance of what will be on the ballot on Tuesday, specifically the statewide propositions. Let's first talk about Proposition 29. That's the, you know, think of it as the cigarette tax proposition that would put an additional dollar tax on every pack of cigarettes sold in the state, and then the revenue would be put into a special fund to finance cancer research and related facilities. Kim, there's been a lot of money spent on this proposition, lopsidedly on the no side, the great majority of it coming from big tobacco.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit of how this would work and kind of how you see people reacting to this.
Well, I mean, we've seen this before. We've had many propositions on the ballot over the years where someone is trying to create a tobacco tax, create an oversight commission, and you've got, you know, the American Cancer Society and other groups who support reducing tobacco use in California, proposing these changes, and then you see the tobacco industry rallying, you know, with millions of dollars, many of them coming from
tens of millions,
to try to defeat the measure. You know, what's tricky about someone who's looked at propositions over many elections over many years, what I've noticed is that it's much easier to defeat a proposition than it is to pass one. So it's an uphill battle for any proponent. In this case, the folks that are supporting 29, the American Cancer Society and others, you know, they've put up quite a bit of money, too. I mean, they definitely have the funds to make their case, but they're definitely being overspent, outspent by the opponents. And, you know, the opponents are making arguments about, you know, we don't need another tax. And, you know, I'm not sure how this is going to go. I know it's hard to pass a proposition. And on average, only one out of three initiatives pass, no matter, you know, what the stakes are. So it's definitely an uphill battle for the proponents.
I think a lot of people, there was a study that came out this week from the Center for Disease Control and Prevention about money from the lawsuit settlement that the state of California had with tobacco companies back in 1998 and where that money went.
Mm.
And talking about how relatively little of that money had actually ended up in smoking prevention programs in the kind of stuff that people originally thought that it would go to. When it comes to a proposition like this, what kind of assurance do people have that money that comes from this tax will end up being spent on what they understand is going to be spent for?
Well, you know, that's, I think, one of the criticisms people can make about any proposition. I mean, it's often difficult for, you know, we make these decisions sort of in a vacuum. You know, we're not the legislature. We act like the legislature, but we're not. You know, we don't have the full picture in front of us when we vote on these propositions. And it's something that, you know, I think voters are increasingly asking themselves is, how do I know the money's going to go where they say it's going to go? You know, I think the proponents have put a lot of controls into the measure to try to anticipate those criticisms as more and more initiative proponents are doing. But it certainly is, you know, often, I mean, the opponents have lots of money to do on research and focus groups and figure out what kind of messaging is going to be the most salient among the voters. And that is the kind of message that that does get voters' attention when they're trying to decide how to vote on a proposition, is this question of, is the money going to be spent on what the proponents say it will be.
Peter, we've got a lot of folks calling in right now at 866-798-8255, but I want to get your take on Proposition 29. I know you're certainly no fan of big tobacco, but you've got some real reservations about this one.
Well, as a matter of fact, when you asked how will we be sure that the money will really go to cancer research and the related programs, my response would be, I sure hope it does not. I hope it does go to other things, because the state needs money for a lot of other things that are probably more urgently needed. However much cancer research may be important, the federal government is spending $5 or $6 billion a year on cancer research. The money that Prop 29 will raise, I think, is $800 million, something like that. It's relatively small. Yes, I think a tobacco tax is appropriate, but if it went to schools or it went to the general fund and other purposes, I wouldn't be terribly disturbed about that.
Right. So your criticism isn't about the tax itself, but about how the revenue would actually be used,
right,
given the overall.
Yes.
Well, and you have to consider too. I mean, usually when people add a tax to cigarettes, it's partly with the idea of driving up the cost so it drives down usage. So the purpose of this measure is not simply to collect more money, but also to have the tax itself be a deterrent to smoking.
Right.
So I want to bring our listeners into the conversation. We have folks calling in. So first we'll go to Amber in Santa Cruz. Welcome to your call. Hi, Amber.
Hello. going on?
Hi there. It's true that there are many more candidates to choose from on the ballot. There is still the potential impact of Citizens United pouring money into the campaigns of those candidates that they feel are going to represent their interests. And what does your group think about that?
Actually, Peter, you've written some about kind of what the super PACs and things like that, the impact that you're already seeing them have in this
year. Well, Citizens United will affect congressional races. It will not affect the California races because we've already had essentially the equivalent of that process well before the Citizens United decision. So, yes, PACs will, of course, play a large role. They will play a much bigger role in the congressional races, the super PACs. And obviously money is a huge factor. And I think one of the things that's interesting, of course, about the top two primary is the fact that certainly the primary races will be much more expensive for candidates because they're going to have to address the whole spectrum of voters and not just the voters in their own party. So there will be a lot more money spent. It will come not only from PACs but from all kinds of interest groups. So in fact, the people we elect will be even more beholden to big money interests than they have been in the past.
Kim, do you want to weigh in there?
Yeah, I mean, Peter Schrag is absolutely right. You know, we do have more competition now, and not just in the primary, but going into the general. And more competition means you got to raise more money. So, you know, that's the downside. That part of those rules didn't change at the state level and at the federal level, as Amber's pointed out. They changed quite a bit in terms of special interests being able to spend freely to influence congressional elections. And so, yeah, you bet there's going to be a lot of outside spending all through. You know, it's amazing, actually, the congressional contests. I was looking through them recently, and I counted up at least 20 of our 53 congressional seats being competitive. And because of the top two, they'll be competitive both now and in the general election. And, you know, I don't recall ever having that in California before for congressional contests. So I imagine there's going to be a lot compared to all the other states. When we go into November, the number of congressional contests that are competitive in California is going to be far greater than anywhere else in the country, I expect.
Well, and of course, we're also having the impact of the redistricting that just went on with all of these districts being redrawn by this independent bipartisan redistricting commission. And part of the point of that supposedly was to make for more competitive races. From what you've seen so far, do you think that that's played out? How would you rate the job that the commission did, Kim?
Oh, I think the commission did an excellent job, and it's more than bipartisan. It's multipartisan, and they really are to be commended. I mean, you know, our districts are huge, so it's very hard to create districts that reflect one community of interest from the get-go because you got to glob on a bunch of places together to make one state senate district or one assembly district. But the result is, you know, they drew districts for the first time with a blind eye to where incumbents currently live, and that made all the difference in the world. I mean, we do have some contests where you have, I mean, the most notorious one is the L.A. contest, the Berman-Sherman contest. Howard Berman and Brad Sherman are both well-liked, well-known incumbent Democratic congressional members from L.A. who are thrown into a district together, and most people are expecting they will be competing against each other in November, and that's just never happened before where you've had a general election battle between two Democrats like that. And there may be other contests like that as well. So, you know, I think that it's definitely, you know, changed the rules of the game in a really profound way that, you know, we won't know the full results until we get past November, and they may not really set in right away this cycle. It may take a couple cycles before we see more independent candidates realizing that the rules have changed and that the entry is easier for them. But I do think in time we're going to see more independents running for office and getting elected.
Peter Schrag?
One qualification, there will be more competitive districts. It can't help given the gerrymander that occurred in 2001. But the commission officially, formally, was never charged with creating competitive districts. It was not supposed to look at the party registration. It was just supposed to look at a whole set of other criteria, communities of interest, contiguous lines and a number of other considerations, but not to create. It was specifically banned from considering party registration as it did its work.
That's the voice of Peter Schrag. He's the former editorial page editor for the Sacramento Bee, a frequent contributor to the California Progress Report, and author most recently of Not Fit for Our Society, Immigration and Nativism in America. Also with us on today's Your Call is Kim Alexander, president of the California Voter Foundation. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. And we've got folks on the line. If you'd like to join them, the number is 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. We're talking about next Tuesday's primary election here in California and the changes that are going on in electoral democracy in California and whether they're moving us towards a more participatory model. And if you have questions about how things are going to work next Tuesday and what effect things like redistricting will have on our politics here in the state, or if you have specific questions about Proposition 28, Proposition 29, or an assembly race, state, Senate race, or congressional race that you're interested in, give us a call and take part in the conversation, 866-798-8255, or send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. I want to go next to Andy in Redwood City. Andy, welcome to Your Call.
Thank you. Yeah, my comment is that on the congressional district races, the problem is when you get the two top candidate primaries, you can't do a write-in vote. So if you don't like any of those two candidates, you're hosed. And secondly, where this has been done previously in Washington State and Louisiana, there's no evidence that this helps minority parties, or one of the ways this was sold to the people in this grand compromise with Abel Maldonado is that it would allow smaller parties, the Greens and the Libertarians and Peace and Freedom and whatnot, to get a place in the ballot and people to be able to see them. But that's really not the case. It's the two major parties, the big moneyed interests, that are going to win out, it looks like. Thank you.
Thanks, Andy, for the call. Peter or Kim?
Well, in fact, there are all candidates of all sorts of parties, or at least list themselves as adherents of all sorts of parties on the ballot. If you look at the 24 candidates running for the Senate, Dianne Feinstein and 23 others, it's an interesting list. And there's Peace and Freedom, there's American Independent, there's Green. There's, of course, lots of Republicans, so and quite a few Democrats. So in that sense, party candidates will voters of all parties will have a chance to vote on candidates of all parties. Whether that will make a difference in the general election, I doubt it. I assume in the end, most of the people who will be running against each other will be either Democrats or Republicans, or in some cases, there'll be members of the same party, but I don't see how it negatively affects. I mean, it's true that on the general election ballot, there won't be a Green Party label or a American Independent label, but otherwise, I don't know that it will make much difference to the prospects of electing members of those third parties.
That is Peter Schrag, and also with us is Kim Alexander of the California Voter Foundation. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar on today's Your Call, where we're talking about next Tuesday's California primary. And if you have questions or comments, want to join this conversation, the number to do so is 866-798-8255. We'll be right back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW San Francisco. We have a free email newsletter. You can join more than 7,000 of your fellow listeners who get an email every week or two that will keep you up to date on the diverse programming on local public radio, as well as opportunities to participate in station events. All you have to do is click on the email newsletter link on the homepage of KALW.org. And thank you for listening to and supporting your local public radio station.
Hi, I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. This is Your Call, and we are podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can listen to past shows there, sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up next. Speaking of which, tomorrow on our Friday Media Roundtable, we're going to revisit a conversation Rose had with Paul Mason, economics editor of BBC Newsnight. And on Monday, we're going to be talking about summer reading. Holly Kernan is going to get your summer reading recommendations. We're going to have some folks who read a lot of books in here to talk about theirs. If you have a great book to recommend, email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org, and that's all also where you can always send your ideas for conversations we should be having here on Your Call. Today we're talking about the state of democracy in California, and specifically the primary elections coming up on Tuesday. If you haven't totally tuned into those, this is a great opportunity to catch up on what's happening, to ask your questions. If you have any, if there's a primary race or a proposition that has your blood up, give us a call, 866-798-8255, or something on the local level that you think, oh, people are not paying attention to this, and it is important. The number to call, 866-798-8255, or 866-798-TALK. And also, you know, there are many people who are just discouraged voters or who see voting as marginal to their lives. We want to know what could change that. And with us for this conversation for the rest of the hour are Kim Alexander. She's the president of the California Voter Foundation, a nonpartisan organization that works to improve the election process for voters. And Peter Schrag, former editorial page editor of the Sacramento Bee and author of Not Fit for Our Society, Immigration and Nativism in America. Let's go to George, who has called in. George, welcome to Your Call.
Thank you very much. One, a comment, and another a bit of information. On the tobacco tax, about one-third of cigarettes, a little bit more than one-third of cigarettes in the state, are sold to the seriously mentally ill. They cannot stop smoking. They don't have the ability to control that. So in essence, we are taxing our tax money, which is paid out to these people, and I'm not sure how this can be addressed, because we'll only be taking from what in essence almost welfare payments to the seriously mentally ill, and they won't stop smoking. They'll simply stop doing something else, eating or some other activity. That's just a comment. A bit of information. The other comment I wanted to make was the well-known statement that the one who pays the piper calls the tune. And we no longer know who is contributing from where and how much to races. And as John Paul Stevens recently pointed out, much of this can be coming from abroad. So we know we're electing people, but we really don't know who will be calling their tune, since there's no way of really keeping track of where the money is coming from, if they're foreign corporations or American corporations.
George,
my comments on the air. Yes.
Great points. Thanks so much. And first, maybe I go to you, Peter. I mean, there's certainly an argument that Prop 29 is a pretty regressive tax. People who are addicted to nicotine, and in some cases, as George points out, perhaps mentally ill. What do you think?
Well, I don't know about the mentally ill. That's one I hadn't thought about. But it's certainly true that the tobacco tax, that smokers tend to be a disproportionately lower income people. So it is in some ways a regressive tax. And I don't know what you do about that. Obviously you're trying to discourage smoking. And if that, you know, if it's low income people who smoke, I suppose that will get to hit them disproportionately harder. I don't know what you can do about that. We don't know where the money comes from for candidates. I think in some cases it's true though. If you're looking at Prop 29, we certainly do know where the money is coming from in that.
And a great resource for that is a group called MapLight, maplight.org, that whether it's propositions or candidates, is really good at tracking where that money comes from.
Could I go back to a question that a previous caller raised, which was the question about third parties and so on? One of the things that has not been, I think, discussed enough is whether they're, and I think Kim Alexander might have some insight on this too, there's a possibility that in, let's say, a district that leans Democratic, there would be five Democratic candidates and two Republican candidates. It's quite possible that the five Democratic candidates would split the vote in such a way that the two Republican candidates would be the ultimate winners and would run against each other in November, even though it's a Republican, a Democratic district, which, of course, is not exactly what the voters there would want. And I wonder to what extent that might occur. It's an issue that's been raised by some other people, and I find that a kind of interesting issue.
What do you think, Kim?
I think it's going to be interesting to see how it shakes out. I mean, one of the districts that's getting a lot of attention is Congressional District 2 in the northern part of the state. And I was looking at their registration numbers recently, and, you know, the district is Democratic. It's 49.4% registered Democratic compared to 22% registered Republican. So 2-1 Democrat to Republican, but no party preference registration in that district is also 22%. So that's the real wild card. I mean, that's what I'm going to be watching, is whether those no party preference voters that in some districts are equal to the registration rates of one of the major parties, you know, whether they come out. And I'm also going to be interested to see whether more folks register with minor parties. I actually think that this could be a boon to minor parties, because historically, you know, people may have not wanted to register with minor parties because they were limited in their choices to candidates of that party when they knew full well that it would be some other candidate from a major party that would actually end up representing them. So this gives all voters more choice, more voice in deciding who the ultimate, you know, top two nominees are going to be. And I think that might help draw more people into minor parties. I also just want to comment real quickly about the disclosure. I mean, it's absolutely true that the money situation is murky at the federal level when it comes to these super PACs. But in California, we have the best disclosure system in the country. We have the strongest disclosure laws. We require online disclosure. MapLight is a great resource. We're linking to MapLight from our online voter guide. We've historically featured the top donors for and against every proposition. MapLight's got that. They're updating it every day. So you can come to calvoter.org and use our voter guide to find out who the top donors are for the propositions. Funding at legislative races is also very well disclosed. So I have to take issue with that characterization about following the money.
Well, Peter, you've been following the money some in the California Progress Report and kind of looking at what the impact that redistricting has had on campaign spending and primaries, how much is going into the races, who it's going to. What'd you see?
Well, part of the problem, of course, is that we're looking at a moving target, and we're not going to know we're not going to really have the numbers, all the numbers, until for some time. As I say, I can only speculate that this time, because this primary is so much more expensive, because the candidates have to address or have to appeal to the whole spectrum of the electorate and not just their own party. That they will have to raise a lot more money, and that they will be more beholden to the big givers than the big contributors than they have been in the past. But we're not going to really know all the details of that. We may never know all of it, but we will know a lot more when all the returns are in.
Go ahead, Kim.
Oh, just to say that, you know, historically, it's been up to the leadership of each caucus in the legislature to decide which candidate is the anointed candidate and who gets to have the spigot turned on for them from Sacramento in terms of where the special interest dollars flow and where all the lobbyists in Sacramento point their money. They get their cues from, you know, the leadership within the legislature. And that's not quite applying so much anymore. I mean, there are people who are running who don't have that anointment that, you know, successful candidates have relied on in the past. We don't know if they're going to win or not, but there's certainly a lot more people who think they've got, you know, a competitive shot at a seat who otherwise would have just been having to sit on the sidelines.
As I look at the list for the Senate, for example, the 24 candidates, it reminded me a little bit of the recall in 2003. When we had, how many candidates we have for governor? I can't remember.
I think
remember.
We had 100 and something. I can't remember.
Yeah, you know, and all of a sudden it was a little bit more like an Oklahoma land rush, a sort of free for all. And there are some very strange candidates in that list, by the way.
Kim, you were talking about District 2, which was the congressional district that Lynn Woolsey held that seat for a long time. That's now an open seat. Looks like a really interesting race. And then another one that's getting a lot of attention here in the Bay Area is Pete Stark's seat. He's got a strong challenge from a Democrat, Eric Swalwell, as well as Republican Chris Pareja.
Mm-hmm.
Both of you watching those races, what do you see happening here?
Well, one thing I've noticed is, I mean, there are a lot of incumbents who have opposition this year that don't normally have them. I mean, I looked at Nancy Pelosi last night and her contest. She's got three Democratic Party opponents in her primary. I went back through the last seven primaries. That's more than the total number of primary opponents she's had in the last seven primaries combined. So there are a lot of more people coming out to challenge incumbents of their own parties, I think partly because of the new political districts, but also because, you know, there is this opportunity for people who want to challenge a sitting incumbent to, you know, reach out to voters of other parties or to independent voters to try to gain a competitive edge.
There's, of course, also the other thing is that there's a lot more grumpiness in the electorate this year. So I think that whether you're talking about the Tea Party, you're talking about Occupy Wall Street, or just the general unhappiness with the state of the country. So I think that may also generate more candidates.
I want to go to Alex in San Francisco, who's called in, who I don't know if he's one of the grumpy voters, but maybe one of the more disenchanted folks out there. Alex, tell us kind of your perspective on this election and how democracy is faring in California.
Yes, I'm one of the grumpled ones, the disgruntled ones. I used to vote religiously, but I don't vote anymore as of this year. And that is because of the legal monkey wrench that is always thrown in post-election. If the powers that be don't like the results of any proposition or nationwide at Supreme Court level, the issue gets adjudicated by Supreme Court or a higher court of some kind, and they throw the stuff out if the moneyed interest doesn't like the outcome. So they put in the cart before the horse when they put things in a proposition style, for example, elections, the legality of any issue should be vetted first before it goes for elections, and then there should be no recourse to a court to determine whether the people's choice is legal or not. That's stupid. That's rigged in such a way that if the people don't like something, well, we'll have our three guys at the Supreme Court. We can buy them easily. We can't buy the whole population. So we'll have them overturn the results.
Hey, Alex, thanks so much for the call. And, Kim, I mean, you try to work on making a voting system that wants to bring people in, but a lot of folks just feel like, well, even if they get to participate and they feel the vote gets counted, that maybe the power of, you know, the power of the vote is undermined by these other forces.
Well, I'm definitely sympathetic with the caller's sentiments, and it's something I've heard from voters before, this, you know, sense that, hey, we voted for this and we tried to make this change in the law, and then someone came along and challenged it, went to court and threw it out. And that does happen from time to time. It was one of the reasons there was so much, you know, anger about Proposition 8 and the legal challenges around that. So the proposition that made gay marriage illegal in California. So, you know, there's this other question of, is it even, should voters have the ability to remove rights from their fellow Californians through the initiative process? This idea that maybe there should be limits.
Proposition 8.
To what the initiatives can do is an interesting discussion that people have had. But I'd also like to point out, I mean, California voters have more power than any voters anywhere in the world. We have direct democracy, which a lot of people in other states don't have, and most voters in other countries don't have. And through our initiative process, we have made huge changes to the way that we conduct our business in our state and the way we conduct our government. Just the fact that we have campaign finance disclosure is because of the initiative process. You know, there's so many changes that we've made, recycling, environmental changes that we've made through the initiative process, that have stuck and have withheld, stood up to court challenges. So I would really take issue with this idea that, you know, that we don't have power. We actually have an enormous amount of power, and that's why we urge voters to get out and vote. And if you're not sure how to vote on a proposition, it's perfectly fine to skip it and move on to the next one.
Yeah, do you feel empowered as a California voter? That's what we want to talk about here in the last 10 minutes here of Your Call. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. Are you feeling empowered? And does that make you want to go vote on Tuesday? What is it that you'd like to know about what's on the ballot? If you're someone who's, perhaps you've already sent in your ballot, a lot of folks, of course, are voting early now, voting by mail. If you're someone who said, oh, I I went to my ballot and said, oh, here actually is something that matters to me, or a race that was important to me. Give us a call at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. You were just hearing the voice of Kim Alexander of the California Voter Foundation. Also with us is Peter Schrag, who writes with the California Progress Report. And actually, Peter, I just know you're a longtime observer of California politics, and I'm curious what you think about the challenge to Pete Stark in the 15th District.
Hello?
Are you with us there? Peter, are you with us?
Yes, I'm here.
Sorry. Yeah, I just wanted to. I'm just interested if you're following the challenge to Pete Stark in the 15th district.
I'm not. I'm following it. I'm not following it. I know that he's been a controversial figure for some time, but I'm not following it. And
No need to weigh in on something you're not following closely. The other big proposition on the state ballot is Proposition 28, and this would tweak the way term limits work in the state. Either you want to jump in and just talk about what that change is, would be. Go ahead, Peter.
The term limits are 3 2-year terms for assembly members, 2 4-year terms for Senate members, essentially a total of 14 years if you go from one to the other. This would reduce the total from 14 to 12. But you could serve the 12 years in either house or combination of the two houses. And the argument for it is that it would reduce the impulse of particularly assembly members to, as almost as soon as they're elected, to start thinking about running for the next office, which would be normally the Senate, and would reduce the political jockeying a little bit, and allow members to focus much more on the business that they were elected to do in Sacramento. Whether, in fact, it will work that way, I don't know. Obviously, when we first got term limits, the argument for term limits was that it would bring in more citizen legislators who would go back to their real occupation once they finish serving in Sacramento. Obviously, that has not happened. I think there's one advantage to this change, and that is that we will have a little bit more experience, especially in the assembly, because you can stay longer, and you will also have an expectation, because you're staying longer, of some kind of future and think more about the consequences of what you do because you'll be there longer. So I think that is a slight improvement. Whether it will make a huge difference, I'm very doubtful.
Kim, this seems like such a small change. I mean, from outside, I mean, I'm just curious what your sense is of what term limits as they stand now, what kind of change they've made in Sacramento in terms of who's representing us or what they're able to do. And then I'll just ask what to me seems like kind of very a minor change. Why does this seem to be a real partisan issue, at least in Sacramento?
The term limits, I came to Sacramento before term limits was in effect, and there was very little turnover. It was, same people in the same roles, a lot of collegiality and camaraderie because people had worked together for a long time. The fear of term limits was that we'd get, more inexperienced lawmakers in and that the lobbyists would have all the power. And I actually have seen quite a bit of change over the years where, there seems to be more lobbyist-written bills, where the bill is sponsored by an industry rather than being, developed in-house by the legislator and his or her staff. But we are seeing more people with local government experience coming in because of term limits, and then we are seeing people from the legislature go back out into local government because of term limits, because they're term limited out. So I think there's been an interesting rotation between state and local government because of term limits, and there's also been a set number of competitive races every election because of term limits. I mean, one-third of the assembly turns over every 2 years, no matter what, because of the existing term limit laws. Some people think that's good, that to have that sort of forced competition, because historically incumbents go unchallenged. Now, because of the top two primary, we're seeing incumbents being challenged more. So that whole premise may get thrown on its head because of this other rule change. But I think the idea is that, you know, if someone could stay in one house longer, then maybe we'll be able to get back to that collegiality and camaraderie that has been away from the legislature since, you know, the 1990s when these changes started taking effect.
So, I mean, the changes that this is talking about, Proposition 28, seem to me to be ones that primarily interest the folks who are holding office or considering holding office and thinking about what their next moves will be and how they run their next campaign or don't have to run their next campaign.
Yeah, it's very much an in-house, inside, if we had a beltway, an inside the beltway kind of change. I don't think that most voters sit around thinking about, you know, the impact term limits have had on the nature of the collegiality among the houses of the legislature. But that's kind of what this is about. A lot of the donors that have come in to support Prop 28, which is not a big bankrolled campaign. They've raised $2.2 million so far, according to MapLight. And, you know, they've got labor money coming in. There's some interest groups that are often involved in Capitol, sort of helping out legislators and lobbying the Capitol, Pacific Gas and Electric, Jerry Parencio, the LA Jobs PAC. I mean, these are the nurses kicked in some money. No one's putting in a whole lot of money. It's sort of more sort of token support for this change. And on the other side, very little money being raised, but it's coming from some of the groups that have traditionally supported term limits in the first place.
Actually, the biggest source of the no money is coming from one source. It's a developer, used to be a New York developer, is now in Philadelphia, named Howie Rich and his family. It almost all the no money, as far as I can tell, looking at the Secretary of State's reports, is coming from Howie Rich and company.
Mm-hmm.
While we're drilling down into some things that your kind of everyday voter may not think much about, I just want to know, what do the county central committees for each of these parties do? Because we'll go next week, we'll see this list of folks, and most of us who aren't party activists feel like, how the heck am I supposed to know what to do here? What do they do, and how would you suggest that people attempt to knowledgeably respond to those lists? Is there a way?
Tim, you better answer that.
No,
I don't,
Peter,
know how to
answer. I'm a declined to state independent voter. I don't vote for...
You've never seen these lists.
It's been a long time since I've been registered with a party, so I haven't seen one in at least 12 years.
But, you know, you raise you touch on another issue, which I think is maybe even more important, and that is that we simply vote on too many things, on too many offices. When I look at my ballot, do I really know... who's the best candidate for the park board or the recreation board or the most mosquito abatement district? I don't.
I once made a joke on a radio show, Peter, about the mosquito abatement district, and my dad was listening at that time, and he actually served on the L.A. County Mosquito Abatement Commission, and I was horrified that I had not known that and known how important it was.
Well, now I'm going to go on and boast that I know the daughter of somebody who was once a member of the mosquito abatement.
All right, so now that we've descended into the most trivial possible element of what's on the ballot, I actually want to step back, and Kim, I want to ask you, because this, you know, just yesterday, Eric Holder, the Attorney General, was giving a speech to the Congressional Black Caucus talking about how he sees the right to vote being threatened by voter ID requirements and other rule changes in states across the country. How seriously do you take those threats on the national level, and what are your biggest concerns about those questions here in California?
The biggest problem that we have with elections in the United States is that we don't play under the same rules. I mean, it's what your voting rights are depends on what state you live in. And, you know, one of the issues that we've been pushing for is getting voters access to lookup tools statewide that help them check their registration status, find their polling place. These are tools that voters in other states have, and voters in California don't have on a statewide level. They often have them from their counties, but it would be so much more convenient if California voters could go to one spot on the internet, on the Secretary of State's website, and verify that they're registered to vote at their current address. This is something that other states do on their websites, and we're not. So we see how that uneven playing field impacts voters. We don't have the kind of voter ID laws in California that other states have implemented or are considering implementing. And we have, you know, a law that allows people to be registered up to 15 days prior to an election in order to vote in the election. Other states, it's 30 days. Some states allow same-day registration. So I think it's a real problem, frankly, that the rules vary from state to state. It creates, you know, a situation of unequal protection for voters across the country. And, you know, I think there could be a good compromise on the voter ID issue. unfortunately, you know, the issues become so polarized that I don't know that we're ever going to come around to it. But I like what California does in requiring first-time voters. Under the Help America Vote Act, there has to be some ID that's required. And we don't require a photo ID. Those first-time voters have to show something that's issued by the government or utility company that has their name and address on it. And that, I think, is a good compromise.
We had a call from a listener earlier on a kind of on a global level of this, someone's suggesting, why don't we have mandatory voting in the U.S.? And I know this is something that's not on the policy, in the policy discussion now, but if we're asking, I mean, do you think that would be a good thing, Kim?
I don't know that it would be a good thing, but I do think having automatic voter registration would be a good thing. It would be much less difficult for people to get out and vote if they didn't have to worry about whether they were currently registered at their present address or they had re-registered. There are so many people who fall through the cracks when they try to re-register through the Department of Motor Vehicles. There's no acknowledgement that goes out to voters to say that you're registered to vote until you get your sample ballot. And if you fail to notice that you didn't get your sample ballot, then it's too late and you can't get registered in time. So every election I see a lot of people who are really heartbroken that they are not eligible to vote because they didn't get their registration record updated and they didn't know how to check to see if it was updated or not. And I think that's a real shame, and that if we had a more automated way to get people registered or to identify people who are eligible to be registered and sort of put them in a holding pattern until they show up at the polls, those would be, I think, great improvements that would really expand participation.
Kim, thank you so much for being with us here on Your Call today. That's Kim Alexander, president and founder of the California Voter Foundation. You can find them and the resources they have at calvoter.org. Also with us this hour was Peter Schrag, former editorial page editor of Sacramento Bee and frequent contributor to the California Progress Report. I'm Matt Martin. Thanks so much to everyone who called or emailed. And I want you to stay tuned, please, hear what we're going to be doing on Monday. On the next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. This week, we'll revisit a conversation Rose Aguilar had with Paul Mason, economics editor for BBC Newsnight and author of Why It's Kicking Off Everywhere, The New Global Revolutions. Mason believes that from Tahrir Square to Zuccotti Park, advanced forms of communication have created a new relationship between the media and the millions of people who are standing up for economic justice and freedom. It's Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast or newsletter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is the executive producer. Pete Misick is our web editor. And Becca Hoekstra is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Alan Farley is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and produced by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in San Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.